Hello, and welcome to another episode of A Future Worth Thinking About. This is Damien, also Wolven, and today we're going to be talking about a concept I like to call the invisible architecture of bias. A bit of this discussion will have appeared elsewhere, but I felt it was high time I stitched a lot of those thoughts together and used them as a platform to dive deep into just this as one overarching idea. What I mean is that I've mentioned this concept before, and I've even used the thinking behind it to bring our attention to a great many issues in technology, race, gender, sexuality, and society, but I've not yet fully and clearly laid out a definition for the phrase itself. No, not here at any rate. Back in the days of a more lively live journal, I talked about the genesis of the phrase, the invisible architecture of bias. And as I said there, I first came up with it back in 2010 in a conversation with my friend Rebecca. It describes the assumptions we make and the forces that shape us so deeply that we don't merely assume them, we live them. It's what we would encounter if we were to ask a seventh-generation farmer in a wheat farming community, "Why do you farm wheat?" The question you're asking is so fundamentally contrary to the fact of their lives, they can't even hear it or even think of it an actual answer. It's simply the world in which they live. David Foster Wallace, in his piece, This is Water, recounts the following joke. There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish, swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and eventually one of them looks over at the other one and goes, "What the hell is water?" That reaction is why it's the invisible architecture of bias, because we can't even think about the reasons behind the structure of the house, the nature of the reality in which we live, until we're forced to come to think about it. That is, until we train ourselves to become aware of it after something innocuous catches the combined intersection of our unconscious and aesthetic attention, or piques our curiosity, or until something goes terribly, catastrophically wrong. We've talked before about what is known as normalization, the process of that which is merely common becoming seen as, quote-unquote, the norm, and of that norm coming to be seen as right, or quote-unquote, good. Leaving aside Mr. David Hume's proof that you can't validly infer a prescription of what ought to be from a description of what merely is, normalization is an insidious process in and of itself. It preys upon our almost species-wide susceptibility to familiarity. One of the major traits of the human brain is a predilection towards patterns. Pattern making, pattern matching, and pattern appreciating are all things we think of as good and right because they're what we tend to do. We do them so much, in fact, that we've even gone about telling ourselves a series of evolutionary just-so stories about our ability to appreciate patterns and how it's likely what accounts for our dominance as a species on Earth. But even these words that I'm using and the meaning behind them are rooted in the self-same assumptions. Assumptions about what's true, about what's right, and about what is. And while the experience of something challenging our understanding of what's good and right and normal can make us acutely aware of what we expected to be the case, this doesn't mean that we're then ready, willing, and able to change those assumptions. Quite the opposite, in fact, as we usually tend to double down on those assumptions, to crouch and huddle into them, all the better to avoid ever questioning them. We like to protect our patterns, you see, because they're the foundation and the rock from which we craft our world. Problem is, if that foundation's flawed, then whatever we build upon it is eventually going to shift and crack. And personally, I'd rather work toward building a more adaptable foundation than try to convince people that a pile of rubble is a perfectly viable house. In case it wasn't clear yet, I think a lot of people are doing that second one. So let's spend some time talking about how we've come to accept and even depend on those shaky assumptions. Let's talk about some of the structures of society which consciously and unconsciously guide the decision-making processes of people like departmental faculty hiring committees, the people who award funding grants, cops, jurors, judges, DAs, the media and their reportage, and especially you and me. Because we are the people who are, every day, consuming and attempting to process a fire hose's worth of information. information that gets held up to and turned around in the light of what we already believe and know, and then more like than not gets categorized and sorted into pre-existing boxes. But these boxes aren't without their limitations and detriments. For instance, if we want to, we can describe anything as a relational dichotomy, but to do so will place us within the realms and rules of the particular dialectic at hand. For the sake of this example, consider that the more you talk in terms of quote-unquote liberty and quote-unquote tyranny, the more you show yourself as having accepted A, the definitions of those terms and relationships with one another, and B, the quote-unquote correct mode of their perceived conflict resolution. The latter is something others have laid down for you. But there is a way around this, and that's by working to see a larger picture. If freedom and restriction are your dichotomy, then what's the larger system in which they exist, and from which they take their meaning? Now, some might say that the idea of a larger structure is only ever the fantasy of a deluded mind, and others might say it's the secret truth which has been hidden from us by controlling Illuminati overlords. But at a basic level, to describe to either view is to buy the dichotomy and ignore the dialectic. You're still locked into the pattern, and you're ignoring its edges. Every preference you have, everything you love or want, or like the taste of, or fear, or hate, is something you've been taught to prefer. And some of those things you've been taught so completely and for so long to prefer that you don't even recognize that you've been taught to prefer them. You just think it's right and natural that you prefer these things, that this is the world around you, and you don't think to investigate it, let alone critique it, because in your mind, it's just the world. This extends to everything from gender norms, expectations regarding recommended levels of diet and physical activity, women in the military, entertainment, fashion, geek culture, the recapitulation of racism and photographic technology, our enculturated responses to the progress of technology, race, and sexuality. Now, chances are, as you encountered some of those members of that list, and you thought some variant on two things, depending on the item. Either one, well, obviously that's a problem, or two, wait, how is that a problem? There is the possibility that you also thought a third thing, being, I think I can see how that might be a problem, but I can't quite place why. Now, if you thought things one or two, then congratulations! Here are some of your uninvestigated biases. If you thought thing three, and I hope that you did, then good, because that kind of itching, niggling sensation that there's something wrong that you just can't quite suss out is one of the best places to start. You're open to the possibility of change in your understanding of how the world works, and a bit more likely to be willing to accept that what's wrong is something from which you've benefited, or in which you've been complicit for a very long time. That's a good start, much better than the alternative. Now, this was going to be the place where I was going to outline several different studies on ableism, racism, sexism, gender bias, homophobia, transphobia, and so on. I was going to lay out the stats on the likelihood of female service members being sexually assaulted in the military, and the history of the color pink, and how it used to be a boy's color until a particular advertising push swapped it to blue, and how recent popular discussion of the dangers of sitting slash a sedentary lifestyle and the corresponding admonishment that we, quote, need to get up and move around, don't really take into account people who, you know, can't. And how we're more willing to admit the possibility of mythological species in games and movies than we are for their gender, sexual, or racial coding to be other than what we consider normal. And how most people forget that black people make up the largest single ethnic group within the LGBTQIA community. And how strange the conceptual baggage is in society's unwillingness to compare a preference and a practice of fundamentally queer-coded polyamory to the heteronormative A, idealization of the ménage à trois, and B, institution of dating. I say I was going to talk about all of that, and I was going to exhort all of you to take all of this information out into the world and convince them all. But then I found this study that shows how when people are confronted with evidence that shakes our biases, we double down on those biases. Yeah, see above. The study specifically shows that white people who are confronted with evidence that the justice system is not equally weighted in its treatment across all racial and ethnic groups, that is, people who are clearly shown that cops, judges, lawyers, and juries exhibit vastly different responses when confronted with white defendants than they do when confronted with black or Hispanic defendants, do not respond as we all like to think that we would when we're confronted with evidence that casts our assumptions into doubt. Overwhelmingly, those people did not say, "Man, that is fucked up. I should really keep a lookout for those behaviors in myself, so I don't make things so much worse for people who are already having a shitty time of it. In fact, I'll do some extra work to make sure their lives are less shitty." Instead, those studied overwhelmingly said, "The system is fair. If you were punished, you must have done something wrong." They locked themselves even further into the system. You see how maddening that is? Again, I've seen this happen as I've watched people who benefit from the existing power structures in this world cling so very tightly to the idea that the game can't be rigged, the system can't be unjust, because they've lived their lives under its shelter and in its thrall, playing by the rules it's laid out. Because if they question it, then they have to question themselves. How are they complicit? How have they unknowingly done harm? How's the playing field been so uneven for everyone? And those questions are challenging. They're what we like to call ontological shocks and epistemic threats. Simply put, epistemic threats are threats to your knowledge of the world and your way of thinking. And ontological shocks are threats to what you think is real and possible. Epistemic threats challenge what you think you know as true. And if we are honest, then they should happen to us every day. New class, new books, new writings, a conversation with a friend you haven't heard from in months. Everything you encounter should be capable of shaking your view of the world. But we need knowledge, right? Again, we need patterns and foundations and beliefs and knowledge. Allow us to build those. When we shake those knowledge forms and those beliefs, then we are shaking the building blocks of what is real. Once we've done that, we've escalated into the realm of ontological shocks, threats, terror, and violence. The scene in The Matrix, where Agent Smith seals Neo's mouth shut, that's a prime example of someone undergoing an ontological shock. But they can be more subtle than that. They can be a new form of art, a new style of music, a new explanation for old data that challenges the metaphysical foundations of the world in which we live. Again, if we are honest, this shouldn't terrify us, shouldn't threaten us. And yet, every time we encounter one of those things, our instinct is to wrap ourselves in the very thing they challenge. Why? We're presented with an epistemic or ontological threat, and we have a fear reaction, we have a hate reaction, a distaste, a displeasure, an annoyance. Why? What is it about that thing, about us, about the world as it has been presented, that makes our intersection with that thing, person, or situation what it is? It's because, ultimately, the ease of our doubling down, our folding into the fabric of our lives, works like this. If the world from which we benefit and on which we depend is shown to be unjust, then that must mean that we are unjust. But that's a conflation of the attributes of the system with the attributes of its components. And that is what we call the fallacy of division. All the ants in the world weigh more than all the elephants in the world, but that doesn't mean that each ant weighs more than each elephant. It is only by the interaction of the category's components that the category can even come to be, let alone have the attributes it has. We need to learn to separate the fact of our existence and complicity within a system from the idea that that mere fact is somehow a value judgment on us. So your assumptions were wrong or incomplete, so your beliefs weren't fully formed, or you didn't have all the relevant data. So what? I didn't realize you were omniscient, and thus making any failure of knowledge a personal and permanent failure on your part. I didn't realize that the truth of that fact that we all exist in and to varying degrees benefit from a racist, sexist, generally prejudicial system would make each and every one of us a racist, a sexist, or a generally and actively prejudiced person. That'd be like saying that because we exist within and benefit from a plant-based biosphere, we ourselves must be plants. The value judgment only comes when the nature of the system is clear, that is, when we can see how all the pieces fit together and can puzzle out the narrative, and even something like a way to dismantle the structure, and yet we do nothing. And so we have to ask ourselves, could my assumptions and beliefs be otherwise? Of course they could have been, but they only ever can be if we first admit the possibility that A, there are things we do not know, and B, we have extant assumptions preventing us from seeing what those things are. What would that possibility mean? What would it take for us to change those assumptions? How can we become more than we presently are? So, I've tended to think that we can only force ourselves into the investigation of invisible architectures of bias by highlighting the disparities in application of the law, societal norms, grouped expectations, and the reactions of systems of authority within the same. What I'm saying now, however, is that in the face of the evidence that people double down on their biases, I've come to suspect that this may not be the best use of our time. I know. That's kind of weird to say 2,600 words into the process of what was ostensibly me doing just exactly that. But the fact is, this exercise was only ever going to be me preaching to the proverbial choir. You and I already know that if we do not confront and account for these proven biases, they will guide our thought processes, and we will think of those processes as normal because they are unquestioned and they are uninvestigated, because they are unnoticed and they are active. We already know that our unquestioning support of these things, both directly and indirectly, is what gives them power over us, power to direct our actions and create the framework in which our lives can play out, all while we think of ourselves as free and choosing. We already know that anytime we ask, well, what was this person doing wrong to deserve getting shot, charged with murder, raped, etc., that we inherently dismiss the power of extant unexamined biases in the minds of those doing the shooting, the charging, the judging of the rape victim. We already know that our biases exist in us and in our society, but that they aren't called biases. They aren't called anything. They're just the way things are. We don't need to be told to remember at every step of the way that nothing simply is a way. But the minds of those in or who benefit from authority, from heteronormativity and cissexism and all forms of ableism and racism and misogyny and transmisogyny and bi-erasure, do everything they can, consciously or not, to create and maintain those structures which keep them in the good graces of that authority. The struggle against their complicity is difficult to maintain, but it's most difficult to even begin, as it means questioning the foundation of every assumption about the way things are. The people without, here meaning both lacking and outside the protections of, that authority can either A, capitulate to it in hopes that it does not injure them too badly, or B, stand against it at every turn they can manage, until such time as authority and power are not seen as zero-sum games and are shared amongst all of us. See for reference, Fighters for Civil Rights Throughout History. But I honestly do not know how to combat that shell of willful and chosen ignorance other than by trying to chip away at it daily. I don't know how to get people to recognize that these structures are at work other than by throwing sand on the invisible steps like I'm Dr. Henry Jones, Jr., PhD, to try to give everyone a clearer path. So here. Let's do the hard work of making unignorable the nature of how our assumptions can control us. Let's try to make the invisible architecture of bias super visible. First example. In December 2013 in Texas, a guy suspected of drugs has his house entered on a no-knock warrant. Guy, fearing for his life, shoots one of the intruders in accordance with Texas law. Intruder dies. Intruder was a cop. Drugs, the stated purpose of the no-knock, are found. Guy was out on bail pending trial for drug charges, but was cleared of murder by a grand jury who declared that he performed, quote, a completely reasonable act of self-defense. Guy is white. Second example. In May 2014 in Texas, a guy, suspected of drugs, has his house entered on a no-knock warrant. Guy, fearing for his life, shoots one of the intruders in accordance with Texas law. Intruder dies. Intruder was a cop. Drugs, the stated purpose for the no-knock, are not found. Guy is currently awaiting trial on capital murder charges. Guy is, of course, black. Now, I want to make it clear that I'm not exactly talking about what a decent lawyer should or shouldn't be able to do for the latter gentleman's case in light of the former case. I'm not worried about that part. Well, what I mean is that I am worried about that. But moreover, that worry exists as a byproduct in light of the architecture of thought that led to the initial disparity in those two grand jury pronouncements. As a bit of a refresher, grand juries determine not guilt or innocence, but whether to try a case at all. To quote from the article on criminal.findlaw.com, quote, under normal courtroom rules of evidence, exhibits and other testimony must adhere to strict rules before admission. However, a grand jury has broad power to see and hear almost anything they would like. End quote. Both of these cases occurred in Texas, and the reasoning of the two shooters and the subsequent events on the sites of their arrests were nearly identical, except for A, whether drugs were found, and B, their race. So now, let's ask some more questions. Questions like, in the case of the black suspect, what kinds of things did the grand jury ask to see, and what did the prosecution choose to show? And how did these things differ from the kinds of things the grand jury chose to ask for, and the prosecution chose to show, in the case of the white suspect? And why were these kinds of things different, if they were? Because the answer to that last question isn't, they just were, is all. That's a cop-out that seeks to curtail the investigation of people's motivations before as many reasons and biases as possible can be examined. And it's that tendency that we've been talking about. The tendency to shy away in the face of stark comparisons like, a no-knock warrant for drugs executed on a white guy turned up drugs and said guy killed a cop. That guy is cleared of murder by a grand jury. A no-knock warrant for drugs executed on a black guy turned up no drugs and said guy killed a cop. That guy is put on trial for murder by a grand jury. At the end of the day, we need to come up with methods to respond to those of us who stubbornly refuse to see how shifting the burden of proof to the groups of people who traditionally have no power and authority only reinforces the systemic structures of bias and oppression that lead to things like police abuses and juries doling out higher sentences to oppressed groups for the same kinds of crimes, or lesser crimes, in the case of the trial record of the infamous affluenza judge, as those committed by suspects who benefit from exit systems of power or authority. We need to get us to compare rates and lengths of incarceration for women and men who killed their spouses, and to not forget to look at the reasons they tend to. We need to think about the ways in which gender presentation in the sciences can determine the kinds of career path guidance a person is given. We need to ask ourselves this: what kinds of questions am I quickest to ask? And why is it easier to ask those kinds of questions? Every system that exists requires the input and maintenance of the components of the system in order to continue to exist. Whether intentional and explicit, or coincidentally implicit, or any combination of the four, we are all complicit in holding up the walls of these structures. And so I can promise you that the status quo needs everyone's help to stay the status quo, and it's hoping that some significant portion of us will never realize that. So our only hope is to account for the reality structures created by our biases, and the disgraceful short-sightedness that those structures and biases impose. to find a way to use those tendencies for self-reinforcement against themselves, and to keep working in our ways to make sure that everyone does. Because if we do see these structures, and we do want to change them, then one thing that we can do is work to show them to more and more people, so that together we can do the hard and unending work of building and living in a better kind of world. This has been yet another installment of Future Worth Thinking About. At the bottom of this post, you're going to find a lot of links and references to a lot of things that either I've written or other people elsewhere on the internet and people smarter than me, different thinking than me, have written. So take some time to take a look at those references. There'll be a transcription of this available to read for those of you who don't like much the sound of my voice and would rather just read the words as printed. That's fine, too. But other than that, I hope that this helps. I hope that this does something in the long term. And I'll see you next time.